This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good evening, and welcome to the Late Late Show. I'm Catherine Taylor, and I'm talking to you tonight live from Buckinghamshire. I'm very pleased tonight to have Liam Selsby joining me on the line very shortly. Liam will be talking about his experiences of surviving the early career framework.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Late Late Show. My name is Catherine Taylor, and tonight my special guest is Liam Selsby. I'll be chatting to Liam about his experiences of the Early Career Framework and how he has navigated the challenges.
This show is brought to you in partnership.
And how he has navigated the challenges of this and the benefits to his practice. We'll be also talking to Liam about his love of teaching and the place of professional learning in teachers' induction and in professional lives. But before we speak to Liam, let's hear a bit more from our sponsors.
With John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
And welcome, Liam. I'm just going to bring Liam into the studio. Can you hear me okay, Liam?
I can, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And, you know, it's great to chat because I know that it's your holiday and mine as well now. So I do appreciate you gearing up your time tonight. And I just wonder if you could introduce yourself and a little bit about your context, please.
Yes, so I'm Liam. I'm 24 years old. I'm now the head of politics at my school and teacher of history. I'm in my second year of being an ECT. And just loving the job as much as I possibly can do, with all of the quirks and the stresses that it sort of brings into it. But it's a very challenging and rewarding job, really.
Thank you. And just to anyone who's listening in, remember, if you are listening in live and would like to join us, either to post questions in the chat for Liam to answer, or if you'd like to call in and speak to us, then please do download the Podbean app and visit ttradio.org and click Listen Live on the homepage. And this will take you directly to the show. And there you can post your comments and ask questions during our conversation. Once I've spoken to Liam a bit more, I'll open up to anyone who'd like to call in. And you can call in by pressing the icon at the top of the screen on your phone's app. Click this and I'll be able to connect you. Liam, thank you for your wonderful introduction, and you know, it's been a real pleasure working with you these last few years. I should say, full disclosure, that we do work together, and that will become very clear during our conversation, I think, as well. How are you today, Liam? Are you starting to wind down in your holidays?
Somewhat, yeah. I'm a bit of a workaholic most of the time, to be fair. And I do tutor on a regular basis as well. Mm-hmm. So I've come off a couple hours ago, actually, tutoring for 2 hours today, and then a little bit more. So I wind down when I can. But yeah, finally getting there.
Brilliant. And is that tutoring, is that for your A-level GCSE subjects, or do you cast the net a bit wider than that as well?
So that's just my A-level politics. Mm-hmm. I used to tutor as well for GCSE history, but for most of the time, many people ask me to tutor for politics.
And how are you finding that? Because politics is, I think, fair to say, it's a bit of a roller coaster, isn't it, these days? I can't imagine your textbooks are very current.
No, it's really exciting how the fact that you can constantly use everything around you as a prime example, and you know, you have loads of conversations with students and you get their opinions, and you can just so often say it's just bonkers of what's happening right now, but it just makes it so much more exciting. And as you say, the textbooks are never up to date ever. And so we barely ever kind of use the textbook just for the major theory, but it is such a exciting opportunity to be able to get young people interested in the political world and make them feel connected to everything.
And I know, because I've seen you teach politics, and I've got to say, if you're listening, Liam really does come alive when he's teaching politics. It's an absolute pleasure to watch. But moving away from your sort of subject, you mentioned that you're a subject leader, and mm-hmm. that means you've got a TLR, obviously, as an early career teacher, which you've been doing for the last 6 months or so. And yeah. I just wonder if you could say a little bit about what's a day in the life for you with that additional role in your job of work?
I think the biggest difference I noticed is now having to kind of maneuver with other staff members in a bit more of a even higher capacity in terms of the professional roles. So, you know, having to make the decisions of now deciding kind of like the curriculum mapping and making sure that we can justify that, now having to think much more widely of Ofsted, which, you know, beforehand I know that every ordinary teacher needs to unfortunately have to consider at some point in their career, but from this perspective now having to, you know, justify why we are making the decisions that we are doing, how we're mapping out the entire curriculum, making sure that all staff members are kind of following the departmental policies. So it's been quite strange to have that added perspective on, but also from a, I guess, more of a personal point, only being 24 years old, it's also then having to grapple and somehow almost justify that I am good almost to be in this position against mm-hmm. other staff members who are, you know, very much more experienced than what I have. And within our department, the former head of the department is still in there, and she just decided that she didn't want to do the role anymore. And so it's then that's been quite a little bit of a challenge to grapple with, exactly, almost feeling on a personal level, am I the right person for this? How can I equate to the staff members, and knowing that if I have all of these ideas, you know, like when I first came on into the role, my idea was to try and sort of slightly change up how we did a topic. We used to do it from the very end of the year, then we moved it to about halfway through the year, and I tried to justify that capability, and luckily they all got on board. And we, you know, it was trying to justify that in a way in which I thought this would be a good idea, but then also having to take into consideration that they've been teaching it for a lot longer than I have, and going, right, okay, so how can I sort of make sure that I'm not almost stepping on their toes and making them think that I'm completely dismissing their ideas, but then also wanting to put my sort of like footprint into the department. So it's been quite a unique challenge in that way, but it's been a really eye-opener to see how, when you do have those sort of like opportunities, the support and the guidance that you have from those who have been there before you is so worthwhile to listen to.
No, that's really interesting. And I remember, because when I came into teaching, I was a bit older than you are now, but I did go into a head of department role very, very early on in my career. And so I completely identify what you're saying. And just like you, actually, when I went into my first school, I was the subject leader of a department of 1.5 people, as you can imagine. and the half a person had gone to be the Senko. But there's still that dynamic, isn't it? They've been doing it for years, and they've stepped aside for their own very good reasons. But you still are saying, I'm going to do this, that and the other. And they're going, oh, that's fine. Try that. See what happens. You know, and, you know, it was absolutely brilliant experience, but not an easy one. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit about what do you think makes you so driven to sort of go into departmental leadership so early in your career?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess it's it was knowing quite early on that when I was just joined the school, that I had already the passion for that particular subject, that I really wanted to get my hands on trying to control a bit more of it, because I just thought when we were doing sort of bits and bobs, and I was like, oh, you know, just tweaking this a little bit here, tweaking this a little bit there, you know, what if this would make such a big difference? And I guess that I don't know, it's the, I guess it, even from a young age, I was quite a quite mature for my age, and quite a let's say wanting to be in charge all the time. It makes me think back to when I was even in primary school, when I think I was the oldest student there, and already I took on a responsibility of almost telling everyone kind of like what to do in that sense. So it might be it just my nature wanting to
natural born leader.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't say sort of like going full bonbons and going in there and taking charge of everything. You know, I wouldn't say I have the huge confidence of that, but I definitely feel that is the sense of, well, I like that ability of where I can take that leadership control, and I'm not too afraid to, if things mess up, I will take the responsibility for that. And there is that sense of where, because you trust your staff members around you and those who you work really closely with you, but then you also want to have that sense of where if something does go wrong, then you can be completely and utterly in control of that and making sure that you can deal with the issues. Whereas if you're obviously from a little bit of the lower down the scale, there is, I think, sometimes that mentality of where, because that's not of your responsibility, you do just have to take a step back, because otherwise you're going to be infringing on other people's rights and responsibilities. And I think that's just, I like being, I like having that sense of control. So then if anything does go wrong, then I have the ability to pivot
and no, that's really interesting. I think we're probably more alike than you think, Liam. But it is so fascinating, and I just want to pick up on something else you said a moment ago, which is about Ofsted, and you've never been through one, so what are you expecting, because they are going to knock on our door quite soon, I expect.
I think the almost the eye-opener that I had from both all the staff meetings that we've had a little bit in terms of, you know, conversation, a little bit of preparation. And I also remember one of the meetings that we also had at the ECT where you led, and you said how, you know, with being with a Ofsted inspector, never to be on your own with them, you know, always making sure that you know, if you have that ability to be with someone, make sure you are with another sort of staff member. You never have to feel kind of like that pressure. I think that from this perspective, there's almost this really big stigma of being quite afraid of Ofsted. And obviously with the things that have been going on in the news and the reviews of what's been going on with Ofsted, it does make you almost, well, from a personal perspective, almost slightly fearful of what they will be like. Because you know that not necessarily your job is on the line, but you know that this is the biggest kind of almost evaluation of what not just you but the whole entire school is like, and that depending on what they sort of say, that no matter what they, whether it's a really good outcome, whether it's a bad outcome, it does have an impact regardless. And I think that it'll be interesting to see what it will be like from that perspective, and seeing is it the scary nature of what a lot of people sort of say that it is. But then equally, what's been really nice, and I think it's just the nature kind of the school that we work in, is this sense of no matter what, we know that we do a good job and we try our absolute hardest, and we just have to reflect that. And I think that's for every teacher. Everyone wants to have that ability to show off that, you know, the career that we work in is one of the hardest industries. We tackle so many issues, and that sometimes almost the unfair standards of what teachers are expected to have to grapple to, sometimes you just have to go, do you know what, have the confidence and the ability to go, we can show off that we are good at this job,
and go
from there. So it's an exciting opportunity to see what Ofsted will be like, but also quite nerve-wracking at the same time.
Yeah, well, I've been through two or three, I think, in my career, and the most recent one was the last one we had at our school, and I did get observed, and I won't repeat on the radio the question that a student asked me during that, because we'd get taken off the air, but it was a very rude question. It was subject specific, but it was a very, very rude question, and the Ofsted inspector was sort of laughing and saying, you know, I handled it very, very well and made a really inclusive environment for somebody to ask such a bold question. But that's the kind of thing when you work in humanity, sometimes very strange things do come up. I can't say I'm looking forward to it, but certainly I think you're right, it's something that we need to just showcase the good work that we do, don't we? And not allow it to sort of become something to be fearful of. And I still stand by my comment, we'll go and see them in pairs. Right, I'm just going to play our news and messages, if that's okay. So I'm just going to mute you for a moment. When we come back, we're really going to dig into the ECF and your experiences of that, if that's okay. Excellent, thank you.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
Behaviour in schools has dominated the headlines lately and been the subject of the latest school holiday social media debate, much of it sparked by several features on BBC News in the last 7 days. Using data from the survey tool TeacherTap, the BBC report that nearly one in five teachers in England have been hit by a pupil this year. The article also goes on to say that other forms of violence, including spitting and chair throwing, were on the increase. Unions also say that members are reporting worsening violence and abuse from pupils. The BBC used TeacherTap to ask up to 9,000 teachers in England in February and March a series of questions about behaviours. A greater proportion of primary and secondary teachers reported fighting, pushing and shoving compared with 2 years ago. The article, available on the BBC News website, features a range of testimony from teachers in both primary and secondary, all of whom say they've experienced more challenging behaviour than before. Dr. Pat Roach, General Secretary of the NASUWT Union, says teachers are reporting violence and abuse, which he links to cuts to specialist behaviour and mental health services, which mean teachers are doing their best to fill the gaps. The Department for Education responded by saying decisive action is being taken to improve pupil behaviour, and a spokesperson added it had doubled its mental health and wellbeing scheme for head teachers. One in five respondents to the survey also said they had experienced online abuse from parents. A similar number said they'd experienced verbal abuse, although the Head Teachers Union, NAHT, says this is from a minority of parents. The NASUWT also comments on the need for urgent guidance on restraining pupils as teachers put themselves under considerable risk of personal assault in Scottish schools. The union has accused the Scottish Government of a complete abdication of responsibility over the lack of a national strategy on the restraint of pupils during classroom violence. The Scottish Government said restraint should be a last resort, but a pledge to publish more concrete guidance by 2023 was not met. At the recent NASUWT conference, Scottish teachers argue their safety and careers are on the line, as statistics showed 4 in 10 Scottish teachers reported experiencing violence or physical abuse in the last 12 months. In contrast, The Guardian features a report on schools in Estonia, calling them the best schools in Europe. The country, small and relatively poor compared with most of the EU, ranks best in Europe in PISA rankings. Its teachers are highly educated, and the focus is on social and personal skills as well as academic learning. The curriculum is packed with wide-ranging subjects, including robotics, music, and the arts. Estonian educationalists say their success is partly thanks to the country's mix of history and geography, as they have the Swedes, Danes, Russians, Germans, basically a lot of people coming and going. If Estonians wanted to survive, then they had to be smart. Universal free school meals are essential to equality. Kindergarten is heavily subsidised, and almost all children attend. Both mean that by the time pupils start school at 7, disadvantages are not as entrenched. Schools also have autonomy and digital skills are incorporated across the curriculum. Pastoral care also takes what is described as a more nurturing approach. It's common to take children out and teach them in a small group, and most schools have a psychologist and counsellor. To progress into upper secondary, the equivalent of sixth form, students take just three exams, maths, Estonian, and a subject of their choice. But you also have to pass class tests. Despite all the positives, Estonia also faces issues with workload and recruitment. Teachers need a master's degree, and the pay is comparatively low. Earlier this year, Estonia's teachers went on strike for the first time in many years. Full details of the article can be found online. Finally, in South Africa, four private colleges have been ordered to close, leaving thousands of students in limbo. According to ministers, the school had fabricated exam results and had failed to submit audited financial statements for almost 4 years. The colleges were owned by Educor, who run educational institutions on more than 60 campuses in South Africa and internationally. The colleges have until the end of the year to cease operation. Students had complained of poor quality teaching and learning, and there have been allegations of non-payment of staff salaries. More than 13,000 students will be affected by the decision. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Hello and welcome back to the Late Late Show. I'm Catherine Taylor and I'm delighted to be joined tonight by Liam Selsby, who's going to talk to us now, Liam, about your experience of the early career framework. And I've called the show rather provocatively, Surviving the ECF. Would you say that you feel like you've survived something?
I guess it's surviving and pushing through the different challenges. So, yeah, I guess surviving would be quite a good way to say it, yeah.
So, you know, how do you feel it was as an experience? Because obviously you have no comparison to make. I mean, from my perspective, I've seen the NQT year. My NQT year, I've got to say, was a very interesting experience. I think I probably got observed once or twice. I think I became a much worse teacher overall. I was very much left to my own devices. I'm not surprised they changed the system, to be honest with you. So do you feel that you did learn a lot through it? How would you describe sort of what you've experienced?
I think I learned quite a lot through it, in the sense of a lot of reiteration. So when going through the initial training, kind of before the kind of ECT, you know, you go kind of through a lot of the groundwork, and then obviously when you're getting actually into the proper job itself, a lot of the program I felt was quite repetitive. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I guess it needs to be in that way to make sure that everyone is got a level playing field, just in case, you know, certain institutions prioritised other aspects over another. But yeah, I think that reiteration, making sure that you feel that confidence, you were able to develop your understanding in that context. I think the bigger surprise was in the sense, you know, as you say, that you were only observed a couple of times. I think that was almost the biggest real big difference that I noticed, was now feeling that we're not going to be observed as much as we were before. Mm. And I think that was arguably the scariest point, because now you're almost being completely not left to your own devices. But I think the biggest thing that I found quite nerve-wracking is now, okay, so this, they're relying on me to do a good job, and that if I'm not doing a good job, it's a lot of me to then think and evaluate and be quite analytical. And I think naturally for most teachers, when you go into this industry, a lot of us are very self-critical, and we always want to strive to do the very best that we possibly can do. And because there are so many challenges, it makes it almost, at some points at least, an impossible job. And I think that was the biggest thing that I have learned, particularly through this program, is that it is okay to be really critical. It's really good to be evaluative. But at the same time, you can give yourself a breather and go, do you know what? You're still learning. And that actually, no matter what point you are in your career, there are always bad days where that lesson has not gone right. And there will be lovely lessons that have been absolutely amazing and you didn't think that they would go right at all because you thought it was probably the most boring lesson ever, but that actually worked and the students learned everything and it was all really good. And so sometimes it's just to give yourself that ability to go, do you know what, you don't need to be perfect. And I think that's the biggest takeaway that I had in terms of surviving that, is knowing that you don't have to be this perfect, godforsaken figure in front of 31, 32 beaming eyes up at you and trying, you know, to tackle their future, you know, because we are all human and that we can easily sort of shape their lives in more than one way rather than just thinking that you've got to be a sort of perfect role model.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that the idea that, you know, you might ruin a year seven's life chances because you, you know, haven't quite done one kind of lesson in history lesson perfectly. You know, it's hard, isn't it? Because we do want to bring our best self to work. We do, you know, we don't wake up in the morning and say, do you know what, I'm just going to do a rubbish job today. We don't think like that. We want to do our best, and it's hard work. And you know, one of the things I've noticed, and I don't know if you agree with this, is if you kind of give an analogy of someone who goes to the gym and they're doing like their leg day every day, you know, they're like working really hard on getting muscular legs and really doing all of the things you do to get muscular legs. And then someone comes in and criticizes your arms. You know, like, I've worked really hard on my legs. It's hard to take. And I wonder, actually, because there's this particular reason I wanted to talk to you about this, is because you had, I believe, a quite unsettling experience with somebody who observed you, who's not a million miles away from here, and that was me. And I wanted to talk to you about what happened, because after that observation, I gave you some feedback and then you came back to me. And I wonder if we could have, in your own words, what happened and how did you feel, and how did we together sort of move on from that?
So I think, because quite a while ago, I think now.
Yeah, it was last summer, yeah, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think from what I can recall from it, it was, I think, a lesson that I think I personally felt was okay. I wasn't too happy with exactly how it had gone, but I thought that, you know, it would be, the main core parts of it were sufficient enough for exactly what I wanted to happen.
Because you'd done some group work, hadn't you?
And
you,
yes, you'd, yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, even from within that lesson, I'd noticed that, I think from one of the comments that I think both of us sort of picked up on, was I manoeuvred the tables around and they were far too close from that. And I didn't sort of like think, you know, in terms of the planning process, of that would have that much of an impact. But it definitely did in terms of some of the concentrations. And again, so all of those bits didn't go exactly so well, but some of the aspects were still all good. And then I think because of that, then having the feedback on those particular areas, and then almost not in a way feeling that there was a huge amount of positives, I think then that was like, okay, so I'm awful in that sense. I think that was my immediate reaction. In terms of that, and as I said, you know, earlier, I'm quite a very highly critical person of myself from there. So I do think, on that perspective, I have come from, you know, many other different experiences, you know, outside kind of teaching, where whenever I do get the minutest amount of criticism, I do sort of like go a bit berserk and I go, oh my god, you know, it's kind of like not the end of the world, but certainly it's a very big, it's much bigger deal than what I. When looking back on it now, thinking, you know, God, it really wasn't that much of a bigger deal. But I think from in that particular moment, in combination, not feeling it was the very best lesson, also kind of having those little bits then picked up in terms of that, it just deflated slightly in terms of my then confidence of thinking, am I actually doing a good job? But when I was then able to email you and then have like follow up in terms of that, which, you know, really appreciated on being able to have that kind of like follow up from there, and, you know, we're able to sit down and then we're able to actually talk out some more and actually have that come to that recognition that there were really good aspects of the lesson, And it was those parts where just picking up would then improve it even better, rather than sort of treating it in this way of that, oh, these are just all the negatives. It was more like, these are just the slight areas of improvement, not in terms of like it was an awful lesson and that it necessarily didn't do anything. It was just, these are just the slight tweaks that's going to make this going from like a good lesson to an even greater lesson. That just was able to fill me up with so much more confidence in my teaching ability because of that one-on-one conversation. And I guess that if we were then to breach that into the overall ECT program as well, I think that's one area that I've always felt needs to be slightly improved on, is not in terms of how it's implemented with the mentors and the tutors, but having a much greater emphasis on having those almost like one-on-one conversations with someone who's more experienced, and having them go, do you know what, I had an exact lesson like this so-and-so years ago, months ago, maybe a couple of days ago, and this is how I felt. And so I know what you're kind of feeling right now. I know kind of like your downtrodden idea of, you know, that you don't think you're kind of the best, because I've been there, I've done that, but this is how I kind of overcome it. And I just, for me, that's the best way that I feel that I can progress, is by having those one-on-one conversations with, you know, experienced teachers like yourself, and being able to almost have that confidence that you are doing a good job. And so that, I think that's how we were able to really overcome that and create an even more positive working relationship, you know, that we have now.
No, that's really brilliant. And I did feel really, really guilty about when that happened, because from my perspective, I watched it and I did notice, as you said, that, you know, the way the furniture was arranged and it had an impact on the behaviour. But it was a solid lesson, you know. And one of the things that I hadn't really appreciated is, because I walked away from our first meeting thinking I didn't actually have to say too much, because what I was really pleased with was how you told me all the things that hadn't quite gone right. I didn't even have to tell you what they were. And so I thought, oh, he's really self-aware. How brilliant. I don't have to tell him. You know, he already knows all the things. And I went, yeah, I'm really pleased that you've been so reflective. And off I went going, oh, job done. Well done me. You know, and then to realise that you'd kind of gone home and wrung your hands about it, I was like, oh my god, I didn't mean that. No. Because from my point of view, to observe somebody and have to point those things out when they haven't noticed that they were a problem, that to me is so much more worrying. Do you know what I mean? And you're thinking, they haven't noticed that there's paper airplanes flying and the kids are stealing it. They haven't noticed, and you've got to let them know. So it was a really interesting experience for me, and an important one, I think, because it's very easy to look for the you know, the tweaks that can be made and frame it in that positive way. Oh, I'm going to tweak this and it's just going to go from being good to being, you know, very good or outstanding or whatever label we want to put on it. But actually, you forget to, you know, gild the lily, I suppose. You forget that the person who you're talking to might be feeling a bit vulnerable. They, you know, if you've already know something's not gone exactly how you planned, you probably are already, you know, doing a lot of the heavy lifting yourself for that sort of self-criticism. And yeah, so I think as somebody whose job it is to come in, and I'd only just started that role at that time, and I was coming around because I had to write everyone's reports and in my role as an ITCO, and not knowing me, you might be thinking, oh crikey, this person might actually fail me. Not that that's a thing that we can do really, but you don't know what the powers are that we have, and it's you forget how you may come across, even if it's completely unintentional. So it was a really important moment for me, actually, in terms of sort of realizing my position and how I need to make sure that I take extra time to do the building up, as well as the, not the knocking down, but the tweaking. So yeah, it was really, really important, I think. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I think it was a really big learning curve for myself, because I think that has, since that stage, it made me also kind of reevaluate every other little bit of feedback that I get from other staff members, because the, you know, working, you know, as subject lead in one sense, and then obviously working as one of the only other full-time members in our history department, are subject lead for history, you know, would come down much more regularly, because she, you know, she's also new in the role, and when she was then sort of like picking up on the conversations, you know, the areas of the tweaks that I could do on that front, I think, and also from the other staff members that would come and see me, I think then I, rather than focusing so much on, oh God, you know, if they're going to pick this up in terms of this, I need to be really downtrodden in terms of that, it was actually appreciating how when, you know, I would actually go up to them and go, oh, did you notice this? And we would then have a conversation about recognising both of us that, you know, actually, yeah, that bit wasn't great. But then we would have more of an elaborate conversation, okay, so how would we then necessarily kind of try and tackle and deal with that? And I know that in the more recent conversations that we've also had, and the other observations that you've done in my lessons, we've also had those conversations, you know, where we boost up a lot more on that, on these, you know, these new ideas, and you give me some ideas to try and implement and tackle, and you know, and that has been, you know, the biggest takeaway I think for me, is that the whilst I recognize and evaluate and be that critical individual, it's in having those conversations where we can be really open and explore how do we then kind of overcome that and you know, move forward on that, and not just focusing just on the issues. Because I think one of the biggest things that, from, even though, you know, being quite still early on in the career, but even from this point now, I've come to appreciate that sometimes you just have to walk away from that lesson if it wasn't a good one. You pick up the stuff of why it wasn't, but then rather than sort of focusing so much on all the bad things of why it wasn't, you know, go, right, okay, so I know that all of these things didn't work, so how am I going to do it in the next lesson? It's going to be better.
Yeah.
So it's moving forward from that. And I think that's the biggest takeaway that I had from our, you know, that little brief episode that we had in there, and then moving forward from that. That's the biggest takeaway that I had from that. So if anything, it was a really good experience to have that sort of moment.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's one of those things, we're all learning all the time. And, you know, I mean, I've had a lot of observations over the years, and some of the feedback has been really useful and some of it has been less useful. And you do, because of the way that we are in teaching, and we've got this kind of high stakes threat, haven't we, for want of a better word, this Ofsted looming over us.
Yeah.
How, you know, there are public consequences for the judgments, and they shouldn't come down to individual teachers, but we all carry the weight of the world, don't we? And it's really hard to reconcile that with developmental coaching conversations, which is what we ought to be doing. And I think because it's been like that in education for such a long, long time, the more experienced teachers have really taken that to heart, and it's really hard, A, to not be defensive when you receive sort of developmental feedback, because, as I say, you've worked really hard and you're tired, and so you're sensitive to it. But it's also, you know, we do feel that we are kind of, we kind of want to push each other. We don't always remember to, as I say, gild the lily a little bit. So it's a really hard balance. And, you know, this is sort of linking into my next question, which is that you're about to finish the ECF, which means that you you'll go up to full timetable. You will have no formal mentoring. That fortnightly hour will be taken away. I mean, obviously you'll be surrounded by people who you can ask for help, but you won't have me or anyone else coming in once a term to observe you. You won't have the reports in that way. You'll have your performance management, but it's, you know, drop-ins and so on, but it won't be the same. And I wonder, are you looking forward to that time, or do you think that actually you would want not to continue the ECF, but to continue with that supportive coaching framework? What are your thoughts on what happens next?
I think that it's nice knowing, I guess, you know, these sort of like formalised reports that we have, you know, that's a little bit more of like the crunch time, wanting to make sure that those lessons are as pristine as you could possibly kind of make them. And I guess on that side of things, you can quiet down on that one. But in a way, I think I've appreciated the level of support and mentoring, you know, being sort of like really focused and making sure that someone is kind of like nearby all of those times. You know exactly who you can go to, even though you can go to, obviously, as you say, all your other, you know, your colleagues in both within your own department, but also within the rest of the school. You can always kind of ask them on that sense. But I think that when it comes to this particular program, because you know exactly that these particular individuals, that's part of their role, is to definitively help you and allow you to kind of like improve on that area, that it's always nice to know that you can essentially go to them and have your allocated time with them. But then equally, at the same time, I am looking forward to kind of going away from it, because you're able to, I guess, explore more even the boundaries that what you are currently doing now. So again, with the extended sort of timetabling, you know, you don't always have to have the sort of like set structuring of that, you know, that I'm necessarily going to do this kind of inquiry question now, you know, necessarily doing this. I can choose whatever I kind of want to do, you know, sort of like for this kind of year group and then sort of this year group. So you feel this sort of greater sense of control in that, in that way, which is quite nice. But I guess the rest of it, so that different managing of having all of these online sessions, study sessions and so forth, and everything like that.
Don't talk to me about the online ones. Oh, no, they were an interesting experience
Yeah, I think that's where I think that's the only part that I can sort of almost criticize of this sort of like system, is that, and I guess I think it's also because obviously it's fairly new on it in its transfer from being NQT to an ECT, is I know that there's been a really big emphasis on making sure that we don't have, you know, the additional workload, and making sure we need to kind of prove that we've kind of done all of this. But when it comes to particularly these online courses, from a personal perspective, I always love the fact of when, as I said previously, if I have a more experienced teacher, regardless of what subject they are doing, but if they're able to tell me, you know, what they've done in this situation, or they've encountered this problem, and we have much more of like a one-on-one conversation in terms of that, rather than having an online course that goes through perhaps a primary school example and you're a secondary school teacher, which, you'll get a little bit of value out of that, but you won't get the huge sort of benefit from it. It's that kind of more personal catering. That's what I would have loved to see slightly more of. But I know that, you know, when you've got that sort of nationwide program, it's really difficult to be able to do, because unfortunately, because of all the different strains on different schools, you don't always have that ability to have that sort of like access to have the, even though you're allocated those particular sort of hours, I know from having conversations with people that we've had, you know, in meetings, and when we've had more face-to-face sessions, that in terms of where they've not been able to always have that, or, you know, the different strains in terms of, you know, the different things that happen in terms of schools, they may have had to miss their session that sort of week.
So I mean, like parents' evenings and concerts. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, it's not always something that can happen in every sort of school. But I guess it's just it's almost giving in some sense, an autonomy to those mentors. Because I know that for the conversations I've had with myself and, you know, with my mentor, while we base a lot of our conversations around what we've been sort of set for that particular week. A lot of it would then sort of start catering off and going, you know, actually, I found this really problematic. Can you help me kind of like with this? And I guess that is the part of the, you know, the process, and what that time is also allocated for. But it's also giving a little bit more of that weight within part of that program, and, you know, really emphasizing that within the actual schedule itself. That would be the sort of main takeaway that I'd have from it.
So if I've understood you, would you place greater emphasis on the quality of the mentor rather than the content of the framework, which is perhaps just that, a framework rather than a curriculum? I don't know. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so, because it's the when you've got this framework, because it is quite a generic basis, I think it's very easy to kind of not always tick them off, you know, necessarily like, yep, all done that, you know, I'm a perfect teacher now. But you can certainly pick up on different aspects all the time. But having much more of a catered basis of where, when the mentor is able to give you those sort of scenarios or put you in those situations, or, you know, kind of live and breathe with you those standards in and of those effects, I think that's much more of a effective way to show not only to young teachers that, you know, this is the perspective, this is the emotional baggage, this is the academic baggage that you're also having to then deal with. Because whilst, you know, with our different standards of having good quality, high quality teaching, because it is so generic, the different interpretations of what you can get from that, from everyone, you know, from a young teacher's sort of perspective who just come into the field, whilst they may think that that was an absolutely excellent lesson, someone who had 20, 30 years teaching experience would be able to very, I think, much easier pick up and go, well, actually the quality of what they've taken away isn't going to be of that kind of standard. So giving more of that autonomy to the mentors and shaping kind of the framework, I think, should be the basis rather than just having that framework.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think it is really important to sort of have a partnership with the mentor so that you are sort of working towards the things that arise as part of your practice. I do think a framework's important, and I know I've said to you before that, you know, I don't always think that expertise is necessarily equal to to experience, because I do think that there's a lot of good stuff in the current framework. I know it's changing as well to integrate and perhaps get some of that repetition out of it that you described earlier. So I do have high hopes. You know, haven't had a proper read of it yet, but I do think that there is an awful lot in the framework which is really, really positive. And, you know, I think the worst case scenario is for somebody who gets a really, really experienced mentor who has not wanted to be a mentor, or who has perhaps by default just become the mentor, and actually it's because they just happen to be the subject leader or whatever it is. And I don't think that's happened necessarily in our context, but I'm certainly aware of it happening elsewhere. And where the you know, for example, I went to a conference, and so it was a primary maths teacher actually, and he'd come up with this. He was doing lots of non-examples, and he'd been into a school, and he'd observed some ECTs in there, and they'd all been doing all this excellent work with these non-examples, but the other teachers in the other primary classes, because they all had to follow the same curriculum at the same time, and they would have been basically said, don't do it, because we're not going to do it, so you can't do it. And how frustrating it was for them, because the other teachers around were just really set in their ways. And I do worry a bit about that. So I kind of like the sort of the keeping in touch with the evidence base and things like that. I mean, would you call yourself a research evidence-based practitioner these days because of the experience you've had, do you think?
I'd like to think so. Yeah, and I think that the what you're kind of saying on the when with the benefits of the framework, it definitely has the, you know, the real big scopes of what I hear from, you know, what it was like before. It definitely is massively improved on giving a bit more of the autonomy to, particularly, you know, for the ECTs to trial out new things and, you know, to have a bit more of that scope. And, you know, giving more of emphasis on that would definitely be the correct way to go. And I think that, again, by infringing upon us the evaluative and analytical style that we all kind of like are, or most of us in terms of naturally kind of being our teachers, I think that we naturally do scope into that way of that we are always looking for the evidence-based side of things. And I think from my own side, I'd like to think that I'm more of an evidence-based individual. I would like to think that if I had, you know, because time is the pure essence of any sort of teacher, we never seem to have enough of it, but you know, it's I love thinking back of like my uni days of where I used to be an absolute stickler for reading any sort of paper, and when I see the evidence behind it and just go, oh great, that's fantastic, and then, you know, being able to implement that. And I remember when going through the teacher training and having to read through different articles in that way, and like the education endowment toolkit, and going through there and looking at the evidence based on there. I love thinking that because there's evidence behind it, I'll try that out and see for myself. And I'm always quite critical of knowing that just because it's been put down on paper necessarily, that's not going to be absolutely the thing that's going to work in your classroom. But I think that it's the combination of that, of appreciating where the research behind it, because it said on that side of things, definitely implementing it in there, but then also being a bit more of an evidence base in your own classroom as well. And I think that, you know, that's where I've tried to find more of a balance between the two, because I think the thing that you're also touching upon, where perhaps those really experienced teachers who've been going, you know, for many, many years, when they've done something for so long in a certain capacity and they see that it's worked, you know, perhaps in previous years, it doesn't always necessarily mean that it's going to be the most articulate way to enhance learning, you know, to the absolute capacity. Whilst it might be just going to that point now, we could always strive to do even better that way. Yeah. So I think if the bigger emphasis on that combination of having the evidence in terms of research, evidence from what we've learned from the past, but then also looking at what we're doing now actually in the classroom, having all of that combination, that would be the best way forward.
And I think going back to the ECF, I quite like the emphasis in the second year on all of the sort of research practitioner and those sort of the building up to that kind of action research inquiry methodology. In fact, I think that comes through, and I've spoken to other mentors, and I know that some, well, I definitely know because they tell me some ECTs don't like that and feel it is repetitive and they could be spending their time better. There's nothing like a survey to make people honest, but you know, it's brilliant, and I think we do need to know, and there's things we can change and things we can't, but I think it's a very good way of setting people up with the skills to continue to conduct their own practice and research throughout their careers.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there, because, you know, I've done, you know, with my inquiry, a lot of it has been in terms of modelling, and that was the biggest thing I took away from myself, because it started off with this idea of almost, you know, which sort of strategy could I really implement in a way that's going to be the best way. Because I noticed that when I was doing all this sort of modelling for the students, and it was also picked up by my mentor, and the fact that I think you do, you know, she said, I think you're doing a little bit too much for them, you know, get them to do a lot of the work. It probably also favours, because I sometimes do find that I love the sound of my own voice when I teach. So, you know, I've definitely learnt to be a lot quieter rather than sort of talking a lot more. But it's, you know, that took me on that journey of going, right, so how do I then get the students to involve themselves way more, but also guide them and have that sort of framework, and then being able to effectively take away that scaffolding and deciding from there. And how many times I've had to go back to the drawing board, because at one moment I thought that it worked for, you know, this sort of set of group, and then it worked for that assessment, then all of a sudden it didn't work for another assessment, and you know, the skills were almost exactly the same. And you know, it was just being able to keep touching on that and building on those blocks over time that has been really valuable and useful to do. And I think that on that part of the framework, it's definitely been beneficial to have that kind of training on there. It might be because, as I say, I'm a bit biased in that sense of where I love that kind of evidence-based research and love to have the kind of data behind it. But then equally, I think it's having that ability that once you start sinking your teeth into that particular area, and I know that from the other ECTs that I've had conversations with, I think that's where they've struggled with arguably the most, is that particularly early on, not really finding an area that they knew exactly what they wanted to look at. But then at least by, I think, halfway through when we were doing the inquiry, they then found more of a niche area where they actually did find something they wanted to dive into. That's when they were able to sink their teeth into it a lot more. So I think that it's really nice that it's having that whole entire year and that time frame to be able to explore those different aspects. And then you can also explore how you are as a ordinary teacher, in knowing that, again, as we've touched upon right at the very beginning of this, and in terms of my own reflection of knowing that I can be critical, but then I don't need to treat it in a way that the world is going to cave in because it hasn't worked. I can just move on and, you know, take the things that I've really learned that's beneficial from that and implement them in a more positive light elsewhere.
No, that's really brilliant, and I'm so pleased that that's what you've taken away from it, because I think actually that's the intention. So thank you for that. Just before we finish, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes. I'm just going to play our messages one more time, and then we'll just pick up Liam. And if you, while the message is playing, if you could just think of one thing you'd hope to see in your next year in education, and we'll finish with that, if that's okay.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
Right, so we're nearly at the end of our hour, Liam, and before I played our advert there, I just gave you a little challenge, which is to think about one thing you'd like to see or change going ahead into your next year in your profession as an educator. And I wonder what you've thought of.
I think that the biggest thing that came to light is not being afraid to get the kids to do way more work than I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Because I give the prime example of the thinking time aspect. I've always had a really big struggle with that. And I know there's a really big emphasis, not just at our school, but across the teaching framework, of making sure that you're giving students the time to really think about what you've asked. And I think that I've just always found it so uncomfortable to have almost like those, even it feels as a someone, you know, standing at the front of the classroom, having those 31 or 32 different sets of eyes staring up at you. And then when you have all these different students having their hands up, and then you just have to reiterate, I'm just going to wait a moment just to see, you know, other people being able to have process this. But it's just, for me, so unnerving to have that. But I know that that is a valuable time to give them the autonomy behind it. So I think that's the biggest thing that I really want to see sort of moving forward on my own personal perspective, is being able to take a step back, giving them the opportunity to dive in a bit more to the work, and then sort of challenge themselves, and then I can sort of like step in when required at the end.
That's really, really important as well. And I think we've all felt it, haven't we? That kind of, it feels like an age, but it isn't an age at all, but it feels like it is. And it feels like, you know, you're a comedian and you've died on stage or something like that. And we just want to fill that gap with stuff, don't we?
Yes.
But it's, yeah, really, really important. And I think what I really like about your answer there is that you've said not only that we do it, but that you've got a really solid grasp of the reasons that we do it. And that, I think, is going to really help you to actually do it, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah.
No, that's absolutely brilliant. I'm going to wrap it up now. Thank you, Liam, so much. You've been listening tonight to Catherine Taylor's Late Late Show on Teachers Talk Radio. Many, many thanks to today's special guest, Liam Selsby, and to all of those who have been listening in the studio and who are listening after the fact on the podcast as well. Please remember there are so many Teachers Talk Radio shows all week, live and on the podcast. Join me again in a fortnight for some more wonderful chat with other teachers talking to teachers. Tune in, talk it out. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.